Hello and welcome to Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. I'm Ian Masters, and today we'll examine a number of stories and issues in the news. We'll begin with the looming probability that bombs and missiles will soon rain down on the House of Assad in Syria, and speak with Dr. David Lesh, a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University and author of Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad. Since David knows Bashar al-Assad, he joins us to discuss what is likely going on inside the Assad family and how much the Russians are frustrated with the Syrian dictator's uncompromising ruthlessness and refusal to make any kind of diplomatic settlement which would enable the Russians to withdraw their forces. We will also look into the extent that the Iranians too are frustrated with their client Assad and how much Iran and Israel are on a collision course, which could spark a wider war involving Syria and Lebanon, a war that would dwarf whatever punitive display of military power Trump and the coalition he is forming are about to unleash on Assad. Then, with the Speaker of the House, Paul Ryan, walking away from the third most powerful office in the land, we will assess why it is that so many of Ryan's predecessors have either been driven out, quit, or been forced to resign, as did John Boehner before him, and before Boehner gave up, Dennis Hastert, Newt Gingrich, Tom Foley, and Jim Wright left in ignominy or scandal. Gregory Waro, professor of political science at Columbia University and author of Legislative Entrepreneurship in the U.S. House of Representatives, joins us to discuss how Republican lawmakers are quitting in droves as Republican leaders jockey to succeed Ryan, and the deep and possibly irreparable divide within the GOP that will last as long as the Koch brothers-backed Freedom Caucus holds sway. Then finally, we'll get an update on the status of the Mueller investigation, just as concerted efforts are underway at the White House to undermine Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, discredit James Comey, and possibly fire Robert Mueller. A former federal prosecutor and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, Harry Littman, joins us to assess whether a bill by a bipartisan group of lawmakers to protect Mueller could allow Mueller's findings to emerge before Trump shuts down the inquiry and buries the report. And joining us now, Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad and Modern Syria. And his latest book is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad? Welcome to Background Briefing, Dr. David Lesh.
Pleasure to be here, Ian.
Well, thanks, David. And in terms of the House of Assad, there's an expectation that the House or the palaces may soon be bombed. It's a very tense situation, given the very overt and I think arguably somewhat infantile threats from President Trump. The Russians are basically saying that they'll go after whatever missiles are sent and their carriers, whatever that means. It could mean ships at sea, and it certainly could mean aircraft. So that's a pretty alarming development. But my sense is that what strike will happen, if indeed it does, with this coalition of the willing that they're trying to put together, would it therefore be aimed at both Assad and his military?
I think so. In fact, I think the military experts that be in the Pentagon are identifying which targets are the safest to bomb in the sense of not killing Russian regular troops and possibly even Iranian. Certainly, we've given enough heads up where the Syrians can disperse their forces, the Russians can get out of the way, and what's left to bomb may be, you know, empty bunkers or stuff like that. But the deconfliction lines between the U.S. and Russia are certainly open, and it appears they have been talking, and no doubt we'll give them the coordinates of exactly where we're going to strike, as we did last year about this time. However, I do think that this strike, if it does happen, will be more intense than last year. It will be, as you said, multinational, with the British and the French probably participating, just to send a stronger message, because obviously the message last year was not heeded by the Assad regime and did not deter the use of chemical weapons again.
But it does seem, the more we discuss this, the more it seems more symbolic than militarily useful. Number one, the important military assets that Assad has left, his aircraft, etc. Apparently they're being moved onto Russian bases at Latakia. And then if you're giving the Russians the coordinates, presumably the Syrians would abandon those positions. So has this been reduced down to more theater than substance already?
Yeah, I think so. There may be more bombs used this time around, or cruise missiles. There may be more countries involved, but, you know, there won't be any appreciable more damage than what was done last year, probably because of the heads up. And this is, you know, it's such a problem. I have no doubt that Donald Trump wants to get out of Syria, as he said and tweeted a couple of weeks ago, in which the Assad regime may have, you know, considered to be a green light to do what they wanted, because that's been one of the few consistent elements of his foreign policy, even before he was a candidate. And so, you know, I think, you know, his initial tweets after the chemical weapons or alleged chemical weapons attack were an expression of exasperation and anger. It's almost as if he was saying, hey, guys, you know, like Russia and Syria, I told you I'm getting out. Why are you doing this? Why are you carrying out these attacks and pulling me back in? So it almost seems like an angry response. And it also appears, you know, to be a convulsive, you know, genuinely visceral response to the images and pictures, which, according to some reports, really move the president more than anything else, especially when children are involved.
Well, of course, the Russians are denying it happened, but France's President Macron said he's got proof that it was a chemical attack, and the OPCW apparently is sending a team in. It's pretty despicable. You know, one doesn't expect honesty from Assad, but I don't know what the Russian game is. What's your sense of, since you've met with Bashar al-Assad, how do you think he's feeling at the moment? Because so far, what we seem to be talking about, David, is punishment without really being punished.
Yeah, I mean, he's actually probably a bit confused and angry because, you know, Syria and people like Bashar al-Assad, authoritarian leaders, authoritarian regimes, they tend to see the world through their conceptual paradigm, through the prism of authoritarianism, in which every statement is state-controlled. It's intended because they control the media. Whereas, you know, they have difficulty in interpreting the statements and the musings and the leaks and reports coming from democracies because it's usually the product of the, you know, white noise, which may or may not reflect actual policy. And so when they you know, see a tweet from Trump or a comment that he wants to get out of Syria, the Syrians, looking through their worldview, they tend to think that it's intentional, that it's a carefully constructed comment rather than just the, you know, the musings of a president that waxes and wanes according to the time of day. And that can be very dangerous. And so I think the Syrians, you know, and Bashar al-Assad right now, he's saying, wait, you know, I thought basically you gave me the green light. You want to get out. You really don't care about this sort of thing. You gave me a slap in the wrist last year. And so why are you doing this now? And so I'm sure there's some anger and confusion, but I don't think there's fear that he's, you know, that the U.S. is going to do anything demonstrative or intense enough to catalyze his overthrow, because he's protected by the Iranians and mostly by the Russians. And that's a dangerous situation, too, when a client state feels it's protected by, you know, a superpower or a great power like Russia, and it gives them the feeling that they can be more flexible, that they can do what they want and get away with it because they're protected by Big Brother. And I think in some sense that may be part of the reason why, you know, Assad, if they did in fact do this, why they continue to carry out these chemical attacks.
And again, I'm speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He has written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States from Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad in Modern Syria, and his latest book, Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad, So in terms of the House of Assad, is there any daylight between Bashar al-Assad and his rather murderous brother, Maher, who was in charge of the Revolutionary Guards, and he's considered to be absolutely ruthless and bloodthirsty. Mm-hmm. But I'm wondering whether there's a good cop, bad cop situation here, or that Maher's off gassing kids that Bashar doesn't know about, or, I mean, how cohesive is the House of Assad?
Yeah, I think it's actually pretty cohesive, and maybe even more cohesive now than it was you know, perhaps earlier in the Civil War, when there were some ideas, maybe, you know, there was some daylight between Bashar and some of his close advisors, including his brother. But now that they've been successful in the sense of staying in power, regaining control of some cities, and on the uptick militarily toward, you know, perhaps extending their control even further in Syria, I think, you know, success breeds unity. And I think they're all part of, you know, this view of the situation in Syria where they think they've saved the country, you know, that Bashar al-Assad's well-being is synonymous with the country's well-being. They've all bought into that vision, however, you know, wrong or corrupted it may be. That's how they see it. And I think they've all bought into it. And I think they're as cohesive as always. I know for a fact they're very confident. Some would say very cocky. I know for a fact that the Russians are very frustrated with Bashar al-Assad, and even the Iranians are a bit frustrated because instead of, you know, using this position that he's now gained to negotiate a political settlement from a position of strength, perhaps, he doesn't want to make any concessions at all. And the Russians want a political settlement and get out of town. Even the Iranians want some sort of political settlement before something spirals out of control that could lead to a wider conflict where the Israelis getting involved much more so than they already have been, and that's starting to happen. So everyone wants this to settle down, and Bashar al-Assad and his advisors, they seem to want to, you know, again, not negotiate try to reconquer basically the rest of the country, and that's very frustrating. And it's very frustrating to the Russians even. And they're trying to put a lot of pressure on them, but it's the old problem of the patron-client-state relationship. I mean, who's doing what? Is the tail wagging the dog or the dog wagging the tail in this case? And so the Russians are very frustrated over this.
But does Bashar al-Assad have any concept of how much his country's been destroyed? You're saying that he feels like he saved Syria. If you look at the pictures, what's he saved? I mean, there's hardly a wall without a pockmarks in it. I mean, there's hardly a building left standing. I mean, it's...
Yeah, I agree. I mean, you know, he's won, but, you know, in only the loosest sense of the term. I mean, Damascus has been relatively free of violence, and they're in Latakia and Tartus on the coast, but many other cities have been leveled, and I mean, the damage to the country in terms of the spread of disease, the unemployment, a lost generation of children, you know, not being educated, half the country displaced either internally or externally, 500,000 killed probably. You know, it's a grim picture, but again, I think he's convinced himself that this is what was necessary. I mean, you know, you look at other civil wars in the world. You look at our own civil war in the United States, where 700,000 to a million were killed and cities were flattened, you know, that was, you know, necessary in order to unify the country, get rid of slavery, and so forth. And so I think Bashar al-Assad, you know, can try to use these other situations as analogies that this is what was necessary, and he's convinced himself that he's on the right side of history, however wrong, you know, everyone else thinks he is on that count. So I really think he believes that he should continue to stay in power. He has every intention of staying in power until his next term runs out in 2021. And it's anybody's guess whether there'll be a halfway legitimate election at that time. But in either case, I think he will run for office, and he may win simply because there may not be anybody else.
But you mentioned how the Russians and particularly even the Iranians are having a hard time dealing with Assad and getting him to make some kind of political settlement. There is a real sense, I think, isn't there, David, that the Iranians and the Israelis are on a collision course. My understanding is that the Iranians or the IRGC have trained up some of the Shia Arab militias in Iraq, which they wanted to send in, I guess, as some kind of occupying force. And the Israelis are just ready to pounce. Now, the Israelis did attack an airbase that was being used by the Iranians, apparently for drone activity. But in that recent aerial attack by the Israelis lost one of their jets, which they didn't lose the pilot, but they lost the jet. And if had they lost the pilot, it might have escalated. So that would indicate to me that this pending raid on the part of the U.S., France, and Britain may be a little dangerous. That's if they start using aircraft and not cruise missiles. So what's your sense?
Absolutely. I mean, of all the many fronts in Syria and all the forces that are in close proximity to one another, it's the Israeli-Iranian front that most worries me, one that could spiral out of control into in essence, a Israeli-Iranian war taking place in Syria, which would soon involve Lebanon and Hezbollah and maybe spread out from there. That's a very, very dangerous situation. The United States, you know, one of the reasons the Trump administration and others have said, one reason why they may want to keep troops in there is to prevent the Iranians from enhancing their influence. And I don't think that holds much, simply because we only have about 2,000 troops, and Iran has already achieved what they've wanted, you know, keeping Bashar al-Assad in power and establishing more of a presence in Syria. Although I think they understand, or they're beginning to understand, where the red lines are. And that's what the Israelis and the Iranians, in my view, are doing right now. They're doing this kind of a dance right now to figure out where the red lines are. I know the Iranians don't want to cross that red line. They did by flying that drone in there and then by shooting down an Israeli jet. I mean, just imagine, as you said, if that pilot had ejected over Syrian territory and became captive to, you know, Syrians or Iranians or whoever. You know, Israel launched two wars in 2006 in that very same situation in the Gaza Strip and against Hezbollah in Lebanon when a couple of his soldiers were kidnapped. So it could be a very, very, it is a very, very dangerous situation. And I think the Israelis, you know, are the ultimate deterrent to Iran in Syria, not the U.S., because Israel is most concerned about Iranian influence. And it's most willing to use, as practically all of its ministers and its military establishment has said, to use military force to prevent Iran from establishing any significant air bases or military bases or any sort of command and control area. And that's why they keep hitting Syria with relative impunity over the last number of years.
Well, recently, my understanding is that Netanyahu was really alarmed by what Trump said about wanting to pull out when he said at a rally in Ohio, there's only about 2,000 special forces working with the Kurds. But I believe it's a very important piece of real estate that the U.S. is occupying there. It's the oil fields that Assad wants. Mm-hmm. It's astride the communications or a future sort of Shia Crescent idea of a land route between Tehran and Damascus, although I'm not quite sure about that. But the idea that Trump was blithely ready to give up a bargaining chip without getting anything in return for it and sell out the Kurds, who I'm sure the Turks, the Russians, and the Iranians and the Syrians would wipe them out. So no wonder Netanyahu was confused. But what is the value, if you will, of that small, I mean, obviously air power is key. That's how they wiped out those Russian mercenaries. Sure. But what's the value of that chip, if that's indeed the case? And tell us about the land corridor. How does that factor into it?
Yeah, I mean, I really don't think, in my view, I mean, that the land corridor is a real tangible thing. I mean, the Iranians were doing just fine supplying Hezbollah in Syria via air. I mean, this is not like 1836 in the Alamo, where General Santa Anna had to eliminate it because it was in the line of communication. I mean, this is the modern world. We have air flights. We have, you know, naval capabilities with countries. So, you know, I'm not as concerned about that. The U.S. presence, though, you know, is very symbolic. It gives the U.S. a seat at the table in the disposition of Syria going forward, especially, as you said, with control of a number of the oil fields. And so, you know, when Trump announced this, again, which I said earlier, reflects, I think, what he's been thinking for a long time regarding Syria. I mean, the Russians were very happy. The Iranians were very happy. The Syrian government is happy. The Turks are very happy because, you know, the Turks and the U.S. are coming to loggerheads regarding U.S. support for Kurds in various cities in northern Syria. So, you know, the Kurds, if I were them right now, I'd be very, very nervous. And they've been hedging their bets throughout this whole conflict, and they've had contacts with the Syrian government. There's been kind of a modus vivendi that, you know, we won't attack you if you don't attack us in the early part of the conflict. And I think right now they think, and they probably anticipate, the U.S. will at some point leave, you know, earlier rather than later. And they're used to the U.S., that is, Kurds in the Middle East in general, used to the U.S. Abandoning them. So, you know, there have been a number of reports of Russia facilitating Kurdish Syrian government contacts in order to maintain their position in that area, maybe regain some of the cities that have been taken by the Turks eventually. But I'd be very, very worried if I were them. But that's why I think they played a game of keeping open communications with almost all the players in the game, except for the Turks.
And of course, the other thing that I didn't mention is that if the U.S. were to pull out, as Trump mentioned the other day, that would give the Islamic State a new lease on life, which again, I'm sure, had a lot of strategists tearing their hair out. It almost could be described.
Yeah, well, exactly. Especially since the U.S. and the Syrian Democratic Forces, the Kurdish-based forces the U.S. is supporting, were so good in defeating the Islamic State, at least territorially speaking. I think Trump, in his worldview, as some of his advisors apparently, you know, they're not into nation building, and they feel once they get the job done, and I assume they'll stay there until they are reasonably sure that the Islamic State won't resuscitate, you know, that it's up to the Russians now. You know, it's up to the Syrian government, it's up to the Russians and the Iranians who, you know, don't want the Islamic State coming back into being any more than the U.S. does. So I think it's a matter of apportioning responsibility. Maybe U.S. allies in the region, some of the Sunni Arab states, may contribute forces into Syria in order to support the Kurds. So, you know, it seems as if he's determined to do this, but its repercussions, you know, could be chaotic, especially if no one fills that void and a vacuum is left for, an ISIS insurgency again to gain ground.
Well, David Lesh, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
My pleasure as always, Ian. Thank you.
Well, thank you. And again, I've been speaking with Dr. David Lesh, who's a professor of Middle East history at Trinity University in San Antonio, Texas. He's written numerous books on the Middle East, including Syrian Foreign Policy and the United States, From Bush to Obama, The New Line of Damascus, Bashar al-Assad, and Modern Syria. And his latest book is Syria, The Fall of the House of Assad? We can take a brief station break and back discussing how Republican lawmakers are quitting in droves as Republican leaders jockey to succeed Paul Ryan. Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Gregory Warro, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University. He specializes in American politics, including Congress, elections, campaign finance, judicial politics, and the political economy. He's the author of Legislative Entrepreneurship in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he's the co-author of Filibuster, Obstruction, and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. Welcome to Background Briefing, Gregory Warro.
Thanks for having me on.
And it's a very odd situation, it seems, that the speakership, the third most powerful, at least in terms of succession, after the president, the vice president, and the speaker, in terms of the country's leadership, seems to be a post that nobody wants. Ryan didn't want it. Boehner got run out of town. Hastert had all kinds of problems. Jim Wright got busted. I could go on. I mean, I think the last time I can think of a speaker, you'd have to go back probably to Tip O'Neill, where the person in the job seemed to flourish.
Right. You could add Newt Gingrich to that list.
I forgot
after
him,
leading the Republicans out of the minority wilderness. You know, they've been relegated to the minority for about 40 years, and you know, he comes in as speaker and Within a few years, he's out. He barely survives a coup attempt within his own party among his co-leaders, and then basically he's forced to resign after his party does poorly in the 1998 midterm elections. So it does seem like the job has become more difficult. Sam Rayburn was a model of stability, but it does seem like the job of the speaker has become more difficult in the past several decades.
If not toxic.
that might be a good way to describe it.
Right.
I think with the Republicans, it's not that hard to understand because the caucus, the Republican caucus in the House is so bitterly divided. You'd have to look back probably before the Civil War to find a party that was so internally divided like the Republicans are, and just having a really difficult time deciding who they want to lead them in the Congress.
But that's where I think Paul Ryan is seen by a lot of people as a failure, in the sense that he's allowed or enabled the Trump takeover of the GOP. He's always sort of worn his morality on his sleeve when it comes to public morality. He hasn't been able to make a sufficient stand, it would seem. So when you talk about the split amongst the Republicans, it's the Tea Party wing and what's the vestiges of traditional kind of Chamber of Commerce type Main Street Republicans. They seem to be almost an extinct species at this point. And I think it's pretty clear that Trump is pretty much allied now with the Tea Party wing, is he not?
That seems to be the case. In the House, it's the Freedom Caucus that has been causing a lot of the issues. They're a pretty solid voting bloc that can essentially deny the Republican Party a majority in the House of Representatives. Most of the time, we see in the House of Representatives, at least I would say in the post World War II era, the party members work pretty much in lockstep. And especially since the 1970s, it's very rare to see the kind of defections that we've seen in recent years in the Congress, both on the Republican side and the side of the Democrats. But you've described the split in the Republican caucus. It's really hard for any leader to negotiate. And an important thing to keep in mind is that the Speaker is an elective position. And the Speaker is elected by the whole House of Representatives. And usually what happens is that everybody who is a member of your party, if you're a candidate for Speaker, they vote for you. But that's not been the case in recent Congresses, in both parties. And that's what happened with Boehner, basically. It became clear that he was not going to get enough votes in his party in order to sustain his speakership. And so rather than face that humiliating defeat, he basically resigned and handed the reins over to Ryan, who seemed to be the only person in the Republican caucus who could unite these factions. Now, it seems like Ryan has been unsuccessful in maintaining the party unity that we expect a speaker will. But it's just a really hard job. You've got a pretty implacable group of folks in the Freedom Caucus, who it's not clear who could bring them in line with the other members of the Republican Caucus. It's hard to know exactly what they want, but they seem like they're extreme even by today's polarized standards. And if you do what they want, then you're going to lose the establishment. So even though the Republicans have a nominal majority, it's questionable to what extent that is a working majority in the House of Representatives, and will be going forward with Ryan's replacement.
And again, I'm speaking with Gregory Warrow, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University, who specializes in American politics, including Congress, elections, campaign finance, judicial politics, and political economy. He's the author of Legislative Entrepreneurship in the U.S. House of Representatives, and he's the co-author of Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. So it would seem then that Steve Scalise probably has a better chance. I think that the Freedom Caucus is much more accepting of him than they are of Kevin McCarthy, which are the two candidates that are likely to replace Paul Ryan. But do you have any inkling in or any understanding, Gregory, of, because I've never seen the Tea Party or the Freedom Caucus as being necessarily an authentic grassroots organization. It's largely been funded, if not created, by the Koch brothers. And that's always seemed to be a paradox, you know, that they're populists funded by a plutocrat. That's an odd situation to begin with. If I'm correct in my analysis, then what would be the motive of the Koch brothers to create a group of rabble-rousers who essentially, you know, throw sand in the gears of government? Is that what they want? Because they're libertarians, they don't want the government to work?
So that's a good question. I think it's difficult to know precisely to what extent the Koch brothers have driven things, or the elites with deep pockets have driven the Tea Party movement. To an extent, it seemed at the very early stages, back in 2010, that the Tea Party movement was largely a grassroots effort, but it does seem like it has been taken over by, I guess, who you would term to be elites in who get involved in American politics and spend a lot of money and try to move politics and policy in particular directions. I do think that at some part of the Tea Party movement, and I think it's not necessarily a coherent movement, there is an anti-government strain, that libertarian strain, that was feeds off this kind of idea that government is the problem, not the solution, and the other Republican philosophy of starving the beast, whereby we don't like the federal government. We're more okay with state governments. And so what we're going to do is we are going to run up federal deficits and the national debt so that there's less money to go around for the federal government to spend. The problem, and so thereby, you shrink federal government by just denying it the funds that it needs to function. I think, there's a problem with this in the sense that it's not really a popular view, in the sense of, in the abstract, people might like the idea of less government intrusion, less government activity. But at the same time, when you indicate what specific aspects of government you're going to take away or eliminate from people's lives, they're less keen on that, in the sense of, there's the famous phrase, I want government out of my Medicare, or my Social Security. Well, that's fundamentally a government program, and there's no way to get the government out of that, unless you want to eliminate the program, and people don't want to do that. So I think there's a lot of incoherence. There's a lot of logical fallacies that people engage in when they try to understand the relationship between themselves and government and support movements like the Tea Party movement or like what the Freedom Caucus does in the House of Representatives.
Well, a good example of what you just mentioned, Gregory Warrow, would be what happened with repeal and replacement of the Affordable Care Act. And of course, when Donald Trump first came into office, Paul Ryan promised him that we'd do extraordinary things. We've got the trifecta, we've got the House, the Senate, and the White House. Just leave it up to me. I'll get everything you want. And Trump, of course, wasn't particularly interested in the details. He just wants to sign something that'll make him look good. And lo and behold, out of the gate, the repeal and replacement of Obamacare, as we know, crashed on the rocks, finally with the thumbs down from Senator McCain. So that, I think, illustrates the point that you just made. But the other aspect, though, of the Koch brothers, if they indeed, along with Grover Norquist and these other kind of libertarian fundamentalists who hate government and want to drown it in the bathtub, they also, the Koch brothers, seem to be getting everything that they want out of government. I mean, even the guy that's now before confirmation hearings, Pompeo, for Secretary of State, he's a Koch brothers protege. Mulvaney is also appearing because he's trying to destroy the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau. He's being grilled today as well. He's another Koch brothers protege. Betsy DeVos. I could go through almost the entire cabinet. Scott Pruitt. So I find that a little odd. On the one hand, it looks as if they're getting it both ways, aren't they? Or getting the best of both worlds, government dysfunction and a government that works for them?
I think that's right. I think it's one of the great ironies of American politics has been this idea that politicians who talk about wanting to shrink government, want to limit regulation, promote states' rights, where, you know, it's not something that they always do, or they do it only in a way that that benefits their particular policies. And so, you know, they don't. If states want to pursue liberal policies, then they're opposed to states' rights. If they are opposed to they're opposed to regulation, except when that serves to protect industries that they favor. And so, the rhetoric is very black and white, but the way that policy works is much more nuanced. And I think part of the problem is it's very difficult for your average voter to understand that nuance. And so, you know, the sort of black and white takes on American politics and how American government works are more appealing. But at the end of the day, I think it's used for a fair amount of obfuscation, and there are people who clearly benefit from this. There are people who spend their whole lives in politics ranting against politicians. But it's saying, it's not me, it's them, or the whole idea of draining the swamp. That was one of the themes of the Trump campaign. And basically from day one, what we've seen is that the individuals in the Trump administration or members of the Republican Party have contributed to the swamp. In some sense, they've made the swamp murkier and nastier. So I think it's a problem that, I fear in the long run, it will just make individuals more disillusioned about politics and government, because here are a set of individuals who promise to do things differently, and it seems like they're just doing the same old thing. And I think one of the worst things that can happen is for individuals to become more disengaged from democratic processes that are essential to make sure that they get what they want and what they need out of government.
So in the last couple of minutes, let's return to the speakership, the job that nobody seems to want, and that Paul Ryan has just handed in his resignation, or at least not until January. But still, I guess the real question is, I mentioned earlier that Steve Scalise and also Kevin McCarthy seem to be the two that are being talked about at this point. I think McCarthy's considered the front runner. But at the end of the day, isn't it more likely that Nancy Pelosi will be the next speaker?
I think it is highly likely that the Democrats will take back the House of Representatives after the 2018 midterm elections. If you look at post-World War II midterm elections in the United States, what you see is that the party that controls the White House almost invariably loses seats. The average midterm loss for the party that controls the White House during that period is 24 seats, and the Democrats basically only need to pick up 23 in order to take back the majority. So I think a wave is coming. I think Paul Ryan stepping aside now will only contribute to that wave. I think it sends a very strong signal about what we can expect out of the Republican Party in terms of what's going to get done over the next several months in the run-up to the election and what we can expect after that election. One of the key things that leaders have become responsible for more and more is fundraising for their parties. And Paul Ryan has raised a lot of money for his parties, and that money gets distributed throughout candidates and incumbents in congressional races. And it's really hard to see how he can serve that role now. He's basically saying, look, I'm not going to be here after the next election. And so he cannot make any promises about what he's going to deliver as speaker. And McCarthy and Scalise, while they may be the front runners, who knows what will happen with the speakership race? Scalise and McCarthy may be the front runners, but they, there's so much turmoil within the Republican caucus. A lot of crazy things could happen. There could be a candidate that is not on our radar screen right now who could emerge victorious. Throw in the Trump wild card. Who will he support? What sort of things will he say that might lead the caucus in one direction or another. So even if the Republicans were to take back or to maintain their majority in the House, what's going to excite donors, or who's going to be able to deliver, make those promises to donors that they can deliver, and that the donors will see a return on their investments if they give to the Republican Party. So I think that's really going to hurt Republican candidates even more so than all the other stuff that is going on that is building this Democratic wave that I think we'll see in 2018.
Well, Gregor Warrow, I thank you very much for joining us here today.
Thanks. This was a great discussion.
Well, thank you. And again, we've been speaking with Gregory Warrow, who's a professor of political science at Columbia University. He specializes in American politics, including Congress, elections, campaign finance, judicial politics, and the political economy. He's the author of Legislative Entrepreneurship in the United States House of Representatives, and he's a co-author of Filibuster, Obstruction and Lawmaking in the United States Senate. We're going to take a brief station break and back with an update on the status of the Mueller investigation, just as concerted efforts are underway at the White House to undermine Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, discredit James Comey, and possibly fire Robert Mueller.
Jimmy was cutting every link between himself and the robbery.
Welcome back. I'm Ian Masters, and this is Background Briefing, available 24/7 at backgroundbriefing.org. And joining us now is Harry Litman, who's a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Welcome to Background Briefing, Harry Litman.
Thank you, Ian. Good to be here again.
Well, thanks, Harry. And obviously, there's a concerted effort underway at the White House to undermine Deputy Attorney General Rod Rosenstein, discredit James Comey, and possibly fire Robert Mueller. There's also underway a bipartisan group of lawmakers trying to protect Mueller. So what do you think is going to happen there? I mean, obviously, at the end of the day, if this bipartisan group of senators and presumably in the House as well could come up with a bill, what would Trump sign it?
Right. No, of course he would not sign it, and he would veto it. Plus, it's pretty dubious that they could come up with such a bill. Their attempts to do it, or their passage of it, I think, would change the political dynamic. And if there were a number of Republicans who voted for it, it might indicate that there was finally some will to push back, at least in the event that he did something along the lines of what you're talking about. I doubt they will wind up passing anything, but just as a matter of constitutional law, even though Trump's hands are constrained now somewhat by the DOJ regulation, action by Congress to try to hem in the president's ability to terminate an employee are not likely to pass constitutional muster.
But my sense is, and I've spoken to others who share this, that Donald Trump is not Richard Nixon. We recall Richard Nixon getting onto the helicopter and waving goodbye. He went gracefully. This guy is not going to go gracefully. He'll take the whole country down, I think. At this point, my sense is that he seems to be getting more and more determined and more bold. And recently, the White House press secretary said that he believes he has the right to fire Mueller. Would it be possible, for example, that if there's going to be an attack on the Assad regime, and presumably they can avoid World War III and not kill a bunch of Russians, He will go up in the polls just as he did last time, a year ago, when he fired 59 cruise missiles at a Syrian airbase. So he goes up in the polls, he's got a boost, and maybe then he'll pull the trigger.
Maybe then he will. That's certainly what they're talking about. As of today, at least the spin is that any interview with Mueller is now off the table. I myself doubt whether how much it was on the table, but he purports to be, well, I don't think purports to be. Apparently, he's never been as irate as these raids on Cohen. By the way, breaking...
What was that, Harry?
...is reporting.
Can you pick that up? You just dropped out. You said breaking?
I'm sorry. Yeah, well, breaking news as of 15 or 20 minutes ago, the Washington Post has just reported that maybe Michael Cohen kept tapes. Audio tapes, and that's a kind of breathtaking moment, sort of like when Butterfield announced to the Congress that there were tapes in the White House. So there's a whole kind of I would say, you know, paranoia and scrambling in the White House. But the idea that now seems to have taken hold is that he won't cooperate. And in fact, that he is investigating ways to get, you know, Mueller's boot off his neck. Comey's book, which, you know, we just got a peek at today, is really vivid in describing the president of the United States as basically the head of a mob family presiding over a situation where truth just doesn't matter and what he calls the forest fire of the Trump presidency. And, you know, we're sort of in the second half of Goodfellas here, it seems to me, where different people are kind of trying to assess who's got who can be trusted and who can't be. It's a really, I would say, wagon circling time there.
And again, I'm speaking with Harry Litmans, a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who is currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Well, when you say, when Comey in his book describes Trump as, and the Oval Office, I presume, as kind of a mafia don, I think it's worse than that, Harry. I think he's a wannabe mafia don.
Right. What could be worse? I mean, you know, for Comey, who was an ex-prosecutor of the mob, I would think it's a, you know, there's a special circle of hell for a mob family, and maybe it's one circle below for the, you know, kind of wannabe. But he really, there are a lot of vivid stories that are coming out from the book, but in broad strokes, the just general, you know, savageness, an absence of any kind of policy concern and complete, ego-driven leadership. Don wannabe or Don, you know, he is the president of the United States. So either one would be kind of catastrophic and has been kind of catastrophic for us.
Well, there's been talk that the great irony at the end of the day might be that Trump is brought down by a porn star. And
right.
The most recent events indicate that may be the fast track. I mean, when people talk about the Mueller investigation, they seem to forget that there's no actual obligation on the part of the way it's structured for this report ever to even see the light of day. It goes to the Congress at best, and God knows what would happen there. It's not the same as Ken Starr operating under a statute. So what's your sense of what happened there with the referral from
Stormy Daniels?
Yeah, with the referral. Yeah, because I don't know what it was that he was referring, Mueller, but then there must have been some kind of clue in the evidence that he's gathered about, and now you say that the Washington Post is breaking the news that the reason they moved quickly with this FBI raid was because they believe there are tapes that could be erased. So what do you think the link is there with the referral and this other case, which, of course, the lawyer for opposing Michael Cohen, Michael Avenatti, has been featured fairly heavily promoting his case.
Yes, he has. Just a quick prefatory comment on the notion that it may be a long time. Another report on this breathless day has Mueller potentially coming out. Now that Trump doesn't want to speak with him, his investigation is probably finished on obstruction, and there's the apparent prospect that there will be four different scenarios: the Comey firing, the sort of dangled pardons, the pressure on Sessions not to recuse himself, I will remember the fourth. But anyway, the suggestion is those might come out in short order. On the question of the Daniels connection, I think it does, you know, go to Trump because the notion that I think led to Mueller's bringing the material to Rosenstein, who then passed it over to the Southern District of New York, is that $130,000 payment might have been illegal in three different ways. A, it might have been itself an illegal campaign contribution. B, it might have constituted bank fraud, and we know that the banks of both Cohen and Stormy Daniels filed suspicious transaction reports. And C, it might have constituted wire fraud, which, as you probably know, is a sort of all-purpose federal, you know, throw the book at them. So I do think that the predicate that was that the in the warrant that the magistrate approved, you know, that there was probable cause of a crime would have been the crimes related to Stormy Daniels. And of course, all of those and everything else with Cohen, you know, Trump is potentially a quarter step, you know, behind in the shadow.
But Harry Littman, when you say the what looks like the obstruction of justice charges coming out from Mueller,
well, you're right. Not, I shouldn't.
Are they coming out? I mean, that's the issue, isn't it? When do we ever see this stuff?
Right now, the suggestion is everything's done. Now, I mean, I think we can now put a different gloss on the meeting before and the question whether he was a suspect or target, and we can understand that Mueller was basically saying, you know, I'm pretty close. If you want a chance to persuade me, take your last shot. And now if Trump is really declining to do it, we may have a wrapped up investigation. Again, just on obstruction. But the suggestion is that not charges, but rather a report will come to Rosenstein in short order. Technically, you're right, we might never see it, but my strong guess would be Rosenstein forwards it to Congress, to both the minority and the majority leadership in Congress, and in fact, we do see it fairly quickly. Whether or not, you know, anyone starts talking about it as the basis of impeachment charges is different, but my guess is not long after Mueller issues it, we'll see it.
Right, but if it comes out via the Democrats and not the Republicans, we could have a repeat of the Nunes fiasco, where they basically say, oh, this is not it. Could they do that?
You mean say that Mueller's report isn't really Mueller's?
Yeah, well, this is whatever, you know, that they're not authorizing it, and this, therefore, in other words, they'd cast a shadow over it, suggesting that somehow, because it's not released in a bipartisan way, it's therefore maybe not the real deal.
I think it'll be the real deal, but I think there will be a lot of casting of shadows in the next few weeks. There's, you know, when Comey starts his mm-hmm. book tour effectively on Sunday, he's going to be pilloried. I think there probably is a campaign afoot to paint Rosenstein as a, you know, conflicted, unethical lawyer. There, you know, they have already gone after Mueller. Maybe that dog won't hunt, but maybe it will. But generally, I think it's A, because they don't have much on their side, but B, because it's in the instinct of Mueller and the sort of mob family that they are. What you'll see is a lot of criticism of of the messengers rather than the message. I did for the first time last night Fox News just for fun, and it's just a whole alternate world where, you know, the only thing that's happened in the last 18 months was the Strozek and Page memo starting the FOIA process, and there's just a complete focus on different events. So it could well be that Mueller comes out with these four reports and they have to move people a little, but if they don't really move in Republicans in Congress significantly, you know, maybe it'll be the no great shakes, but I do think we'll understand, and people understand, this is Mueller's report. It may stop short of being really definitive in its findings. I can imagine him taking his mission as being the setting out of facts rather than the kind of stitching together of legal charges.
Mm-hmm.
And then it'll, you know, look like some bad things that Trump has done that really are no great surprise. We know what he did with Sessions. We know what he did with Comey. We know what he did, we think, with dangling pardons. And the fourth one now has come to me, which is the alteration of the memo for the explanation of the famous June meeting with the Russians, his role on the plane with his son, by the way. So this is going to be bad news for Don Trump Jr., whether that constituted, obstruction of justice. So, you know, people who are persuaded already will be more persuaded. I think some people who aren't should be, but he keeps banking on his base and the indifference or political cravenness of Republicans in Congress, maybe with Ryan's having left, or, you know, announcing his departure, and with the possibility that the majority will turn in the House, maybe that starts to alter the political calculations of some of the Republicans. But for sure, we're not seeing, you know, the emergence of statesmen or women to tell Trump, you know, as Goldwater told Nixon, the time has come to walk away.
Well, indeed, we get what we learn, of course, comes via these indictments, and there's more to it than just the obstruction of justice. There's the whole Russian question. So I thank you. And by the way,
that he's still working on.
Exactly.
That won't come up for a while. Yeah.
Exactly. So, Harry Lipman, I'm looking forward to seeing you on Sunday at the UCLA Hammer Forum that I'm moderating with you and Congressman Ted Lieu, the Trump-Russia investigation. That's at 2 p.m. on Sunday. And of course, Harry Lipman is a former United States Attorney and Deputy Assistant Attorney General in the Justice Department, who's currently a professor of political science at the University of California, San Diego. Thanks for joining us, Harry.
Thank you. And I just want to say I'm really looking forward to Sunday, too. That sounds like a great program. I'd love to. Well, I will be there, but even if I weren't talking, I'd want to be in the audience. So thank you for putting it together.
Well, I look forward, and I hope all of our listeners join us on Sunday at 2 p.m. This has been Background Briefing. I'm Ian Masters. I'd like to thank producer Graham Fitzgibbon. This program is available for podcasting at backgroundbriefing.org. And also like to thank Kathleen Ash, the assistant producer. And I'll be back again on Sunday at 11 a.m. Bye for now.
Sing something to me. An angel song about the home of the brave and the land here, the free, one time, one night in America.